Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, Ken continues our logic discussion vis-a-vis quantum mechanics. And Ken, you've had a worthwhile discussion with a person on social media that you introduced last time, and you're going to continue this time. And one of the questions that comes up that you hinted at last time is there a different kind of logic?
Yes. Yes. I want to do a little bit of a review, kind of put our cards back on the table in terms of the laws of logic and quantum mechanics. Then I want to look at two things, Joe. I want to look at the question of, does logic remove the possibility of mystery? Because in Christian theology, the Trinity, the Incarnation, they're not illogical, but they seem mysterious. So does logic remove all mystery? And then I want to ask the question, are there other kinds of logic? Maybe if I became a Buddhist, I'd have to get rid of Peter Kreef's book and accept some book written by a particular Buddha, for example. So that's where I want to go.
All right.
Let's talk a little bit again about the law of logic, the law of non-contradiction, the law of excluded middle, the law of identity. These are kind of bedrock logical principles. They tell us about the nature of reality. The law of non-contradiction says nothing can be and not be at the same time and in the same way. And so when we think about this, traditionally these laws of logic have dictated thought, speech, and action. And last time we did a little thought experiment. You know, if I have a book, to think about that book and not think about a light bulb and not think about some spaghetti or not think about, a chicken, the law of non-contradiction has to function. Because if a book can be everything that's not a book, if I violate the law of non-contradiction where A can equal non-A, that would say a book is everything that's not a book. But to think about it, I have to be able to think about a book and distinguish it from other things that are not a book. And I have to think about this book rather than all those other books.
Yeah.
So to think, now to speak, if I want to say to Dave, go to my library and get my copy of, Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. If the law of non-contradiction doesn't hold, then
I could come back with anything.
You could come back with anything, a taco from the local restaurant.
Right.
I can.
You
have
more. And you would argue with me, you didn't bring the book, and I'd say, what do you mean?
That's right.
But you have
Why
more.
Do you say that this isn't what you asked for?
You have more than one copy, so he could have brought the wrong one.
It is true. The people that I like to read, I tend to have multiple copies. So can I think, can I speak, can I act? To think about something involves the law of non-contradiction. I'm thinking now about a book rather than a non-book, and I'm thinking about a particular book rather than all those other particular books. And if I want to say that book, if I want to say Mere Christianity, I have to say there is a book that's different than all other books, and it's that particular book. And if I want somebody to go and pick it up, well, how do I do that? So these laws of logic, they seem conceptually necessary. They seem ontologically real. They seem kind of the foundation for our basic ways of thinking. In Western tradition, we have not thought about them as being invented but discovered. And we don't think about them as merely being helpful tools. We think about them as describing the nature of reality itself. So that's a very exalted view. So for somebody to say that the law of non-contradiction could be overthrown, the consensus of Western civilization, that would undermine the very nature of conceptual reality. Now, we also talked about quantum mechanics, and a friend of mine and I were interacting on social media, and he is a neuroscientist, and he said, wait a second here, quantum mechanics seems to challenge the very nature of of the law of non-contradiction, because it says that light can be a particle and not a particle, a wave and not a wave. But as we talked about last time, and as Dave explained, you know, quantum, at the quantum level, quantum mechanics is different than classical mechanics. It's at this very tiny level, the subatomic particles. These things are very small. They're hard to measure, and they're hard to interpret. So the problem is not that a particle is a particle and not a particle, a wave and not a wave. Rather, sometimes we're not sure where it's at. And we're under certain experimental conditions, it behaves like a wave. Change the experimental condition, it behaves like a particle. And then we have to measure and interpret. So the problem at that level is a matter of measuring and interpreting, not a violation of the law of non-contradiction. By the way, we couldn't measure and interpret without appealing to the laws of logic. Now, my friend, however, responded to me, and I want to read what he said and talk about how I responded to him. He says this. He said, quote, "You may be right about the relationship between quantum mechanics and the law of non-contradiction, but I remain skeptical. I have just been transparent about my doubts, as I do not think faith and doubt are incompatible. The opposite of faith is not doubt, it's certainty." He quotes Anne Lamont. He continues, "I think that given an infinite God, we should not expect in our finitude to fully comprehend either God or the universe he created. This notion is not without biblical precedent." He cites Isaiah 55, Proverbs 3:5. "Don't get me wrong, there is much we can know," Romans 1:18-20, "and I am all for pushing our understanding to its limits, but there are limits, and I'm okay with that. Perhaps God created in such a way to increase the likelihood that we stay humble." Now, I think what my friend is getting at here is that, you know, even if quantum mechanics is not a violation of the law of non-contradiction, and I think it's clearly not, all of the people like Dave who have PhDs in physics that I've talked to about quantum mechanics, they say the traditional interpretation does not violate the law of non-contradiction. But I have read some other books where they've had more mystical interpretations, and these people tend to move in that kind of mystical tradition. Now, I think what my friend here is saying is, look, okay, maybe you're right that quantum mechanics doesn't violate the law of non-contradiction, but he seems concerned that the laws of logic kind of take mystery away from us. You know, we're finite creatures. God is an infinite being. The world that he made is very complicated. We have limitations and boundaries. He seems concerned that the law of non-contradiction will take away these things, and he wants to insist that we're never going to understand the world completely, and we're never going to understand God completely. Well, I don't have a problem with that. I think that's correct, but I don't think the law of non-contradiction takes any of that away. Mm-hmm. I think the law of non-contradiction is our anchor for understanding ideas. It's certainly true that a finite creature is never going to fully comprehend an infinite creature. So God is an infinite, eternal, tripersonal being. I am a finite, temporal, a single person being. I don't see any reason to think that even in the next world, in the eternal world, that I'm going to be able to fully comprehend God.
Exactly.
I'm never going to know the relations of the members of the Trinity the way they understand the relationship of the persons of
the Trinity.
But you'll
get to read books on it for all eternity.
Yeah. I don't. And that makes me very happy.
Who's writing those books?
Well, I'm happy just to know a little bit more than I know now. And I'm happy to you know, the book of Revelation says that we'll see face to face. Is that a metaphor? I suspect it is. But I think it's a metaphor for there'll be a lot greater intimacy with God. Mm-hmm. We'll be able to have a connection with him and interact with him, see him, whatever it is that we see, whatever interaction that we have. Well, so I'm going to agree with my friend that, you know, God is a very complicated subject.
You know, that he made this comment that maybe God, when he created it in a way that we couldn't figure it out. But I don't quite like that in the sense that I don't think he obscured anything purposely. I think he just, when he created, the fact is that he's creating things that we'll never understand or we'll never plumb the depths of. Just because, like you say, he's infinite and we're finite. So it's not that he's purposely obscuring anything. It's just that we're finite and we're never going to figure it out.
That's exactly right. God is infinite. He's eternal. And it seems like the more we understand about the cosmos, the more complicated it gets. The deeper we dig, the more complicated it gets. But that doesn't... Logic doesn't rule that out. Logic means that these things that we only partly understand are meaningful to us.
Right.
If we remove the laws of logic, we would remove all meaning. Mm-hmm. The laws of logic help us to understand what we do understand, and they also help us to anticipate what more could we possibly understand mm-hmm. about this. And I want to say something about Christian doctrine and Christian theology. Let's take a couple of the mysteries of Christianity. Let's talk a little bit about the Trinity, the Incarnation, and the Atonement. Maybe the big three, but there's any number of others that we could tackle. They seem mysterious to us, but by being mysterious, we don't mean that they're unintelligible. We don't mean that we can't have some understanding, that there isn't some clarity of thought. They're incomprehensible. That is, we can't get our mind totally around them. But, you know, I think that the laws of logic allow me to say, well, in terms of what God is one. But in terms of who God is, God's three. So the doctrine of the Trinity is not a formal contradiction. We're not saying God is one in a way that he's not three, and he's three in a way that he's not one. We're saying the way in which God is one, he's not three. But in a different sense, he's three than the sense he's one. So I'm making these logical distinctions, right? Now, how is it that God is one being, three persons? Well, I can distinguish the logical principles, but to fully comprehend what that means, you know, God is beyond me. Mm-hmm. Christian theology, Christian doctrine, I don't think does any damage to logic. Because the challenge is not that it's illogical. The challenge is we can't exhaust it. We can't get our mind right. Let's talk about the Incarnation.
You know, let me interject something here that in science, as science understands more and more, they come to the conclusion that they don't need God.
Yeah.
In other words, they're using their logic, they're using their minds and their ability to do mathematics to discover and understand, so that they claim now that we understand it so well, we don't need God anymore.
Yeah.
And I suspect that he's worried about that happening in theology, that we'll use logic to, you know, understand or comprehend, say, the Trinity or the Incarnation or the Atonement in such a way that it takes you almost don't need God anymore, or you don't. To kind of get the analogy that I'm trying to draw here?
I think so. Let me say this.
We don't need the Holy Spirit anymore to reveal.
That's right. That's right.
We can figure it all out with our minds.
Yeah, and I think there are times where it's very ironic. We use the very gifts God gives us to conclude that we don't need him anymore.
Right.
That's a strange position to be in. But think about it for a moment. When thoughtful people want to understand something, whether they're scientists, philosophers, mathematicians, logicians, theologians, whenever thoughtful people want to understand something, they appeal to a particular conceptual toolbox. They appeal to mathematics. Mm-hmm. They appeal to the laws of physics. They appeal to the laws of logic. They keep reaching to this toolbox. We can't understand this. They pull out their toolbox. Logic, physics, mathematics, universals. Now the question is, how did that toolbox come to be? Mm-hmm. Where did that toolbox come from? Because all thoughtful people, all careful people appeal to these, what I call the preconditions for reality. You know, scientists can't do what they do without appealing to the laws of physics. Logicians can't do what they do without appealing to the laws of logic. There appear to be the nature of reality. We could put ethics in that toolbox as well. Which worldview has the best explanation for the preconditions of reality? Not the universe, but the things, the conceptual tools we use to study and track the universe. To relate it to Dave's comment, I think that people who love the life of the mind, who love the cerebral life, who love study, who love reflection, whether they're a scientist, a philosopher, a logician, an engineer, a doctor, whoever it may be, there is, always a temptation to think that you figured it out. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, you uniquely kind of hold this, whereas from a Christian point of view, you're created by God. You are endowed by God. God is the source not only of your mind and your body and your ability to think and to reason, but God is also the one that is in control of this toolbox that contain the preconditions for reality. So in a sense, I think it's absolutely right that Christians would love God with their mind. Dave, I think when you studied physics and mathematics, you were loving God with your mind. Joe, I think when you studied English and writing and editing, you were loving God with your mind. Now, to take credit for all that is really kind of a silly point of view, but it does show you that sin can blind us to things. There are times I might want to complain about my parents. My parents didn't do this for me, or my parents didn't do that for me. But I think, you know, I had a World War II father. If my dad would have hugged me after I got up off the floor in shock, I would have said, "What have you done with my dad?" But I think if you would ask my dad, "Do you love your son, Ken?" I know what he'd say. He'd say, "Well, does he have a roof over his head? Is there a refrigerator with food in it? Does he have clothes to put on when he goes to school? Why are you asking me whether I love my son?" Now, of course, you could go further and say, well, you know, how about the emotional elements and things like that? But the idea here is I'm complaining about my parents, and yet I'm utilizing my parents' capital. You know, when I reached the age of a teenager, I'd argue with my dad, and I knew I'd reached a point where I could take his arguments apart and I could irritate him. But thoughtful people realize, you know, I owe my parents a lot. My parents loved me. My parents cared for me. My parents were able to give me what they didn't have. And then I turn around and claim it's all mine. That's an analogy for God. God has given us all of the things that we have. Now, you know, Dave, if you didn't study hard in physics and math, you wouldn't have graduated from a prestigious mathematical school. Joe, you were endowed with things from God, but, you know, the Catholic school system put you to the press and you had to study or you'd flunk out. You certainly have a right to say, hey, I've accomplished something here. But think of the backdrop of God making all of those things possible. But I guess the point I really want to make is sin can blind us. And that's diabolical, I think, that the sin of pride can make me somehow think I'm something that I'm really not. And when I talk with non-Christians who say, who love the tool chest, logic, laws of physics, they love that conceptual world, but it could be that they're blinded. And that's exactly what the Apostle Paul says, that sin can blind us. We're operating based upon motives that we really are not totally conscious of. That's a kind of a scary thing. And that's why God has to enlighten you, right? And we get into all these discussions, theological discussions. Now, let's come back to these kinds of issues that we've been talking about. I think that the laws of logic, they don't take away the mystery. There are things that we cannot fully understand. There are things that we cannot fully comprehend. The Trinity and the Incarnation and the Atonement are meaningful and understandable, though not totally comprehensive. I can't own them. I cannot get my mind around God. There are a lot of things like that. World War II. I've been studying it my whole life, and sometimes I just sit back and say, I can't believe it happened. I can't believe the enormity of it. I can understand parts of it. I don't think that the Trinity, the Incarnation, and the Atonement are mysteries that do any damage to logic and reason. They're just our real limitations as to our ability to fully comprehend them. So I don't think that the laws of logic steal away mystery. And I agree with my friend that, we're never probably going to understand totally the universe that God made, or himself, God himself.
You know, one thing that happens with people, Christians, is that they'll use the mysterious aspect of our understanding as a reason not to plumb the depths and not to research and not to investigate and not to use whatever tools that you have to gain as much understanding as you possibly can.
That's right.
They'll say, oh, well, it's a mystery. Why are you even bothering to analyze it or to try and understand the atonement and come up with different theories of the atonement? It's all a mystery. Why are you even wasting your time on this?
Yeah.
And I think that's wrong. I think God wants us to search for understanding like we would seek after gold or after silver. There's a depth here of understanding that can be had for the person who's willing to invest.
I think that that's a great point, Dave. I mean, when we, when I talk about the human volition and God's sovereignty being mysteries, I don't mean by that there aren't any ways to kind of try to make them sensible or meaningful. I'm not enamored by middle knowledge or Molinism.
Right.
I think there are some serious problems. But my compatibilism, that the idea, and I think I'm getting it from a reasonable interpretation of Scripture, that God is sovereign and I'm a volitional creature, and they're both true simultaneously. Now, how they're true simultaneously, I'm not quite sure. I can present a model, for how I think something like that can be true. Again, going back to my parents, nature and nurture. You know, I got chromosomes from mom and from dad. I was nurtured in their family, good and bad, whatever it may be. My parents have had more influence on me than anyone, except for maybe my wife. Now the question is, yet with all of that influence, nature, DNA, and nurture, the environmental parts, with all of that huge influence, I'm still kin. And I still make decisions. And there are times where I differ with my parents. And there are times where I opt for alternative ideas. That shows me that you could have an enormous influence and yet still be responsible in some sense. And of course, we get into the question of determinism and freedom. Does determinism wipe out any kind of freedom? And then we introduce the idea of libertarian freedom. Well, again, we're dealing with this question, as Dave, I think, put it very well. Why can't we dig? Why can't we work through these kinds of issues? Why can't we reason through? Of course, the qualification I would make is we want to rely heavily on what God has revealed.
Mm-hmm. There has to be a humility.
And we can get off the track. We can start emphasizing too much the human will to a place where the human will plays a role in your salvation to the point where you can save yourself. Or we, as Calvinists sometimes do, and I can say that because I'm Reformed, sometimes I think Reformed people give you the impression that God it's fatalism. And I don't think Reformed theology reflects fatalism at all. Mm-hmm. So you want to qualify those kinds of things. But you're right. I think God is pleased when he creates creatures and we strive to think through these things. I was talking with an atheist one time, and he said to me, well, are you an apologist or are you a truth seeker? And I think what he meant by that was, are you just seeking to defend Christianity at all costs? Or are you really about finding truth, even if truth might conflict with your Christianity? And I said, well, look, it's not likely that I'm going to give up Christianity and become an atheist. I've been a Christian for a long time. I think I have good reasons to believe it. But I haven't stopped thinking. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, what I read in Scripture is God wants me to be a truth seeker because he is ultimate truth with a capital T. So these ideas, the laws of logic, I don't think remove mystery. Mm-hmm. And Dave talks about humility. I think that's exactly right.
There's theologians that think they have it all figured out, say. I mean, we've bumped up against people who, you know, the pastor thinks that he's got the whole story, or he, you know, a theologian has gotten, like, end times viewpoints of, you know, what's going to happen in the end times. We read somebody who says they've got it all figured out, and we kind of, well, I'm not so sure.
and
you'd like to see a little humility in.
And one of the things I like about the historic Christian creeds is they're very measured, they're very careful, they give you boundaries. Okay, right. Here, when it comes to the Trinity or the Incarnation, you have to keep these ideas balanced. If you go over here, you've gone too far. You're outside historic
what
Christianity.
Scripture reveals.
But they don't tell you exactly how Jesus is both God and man or how the one God is the three persons. Mm-hmm. You can't say this, but if you affirm this, you've got some room to maneuver. I think that that's wise. I mean, I've spent a good bit of my adult life studying the Bible, but it's one of those great books that mm-hmm. I keep going back to, and I can never fully exhaust it.
I was talking with an unbelieving friend recently, and he was asking me, why do I, you know, if I have reasons to believe in the thing, I don't have to have faith anymore. Why do you study the Bible? You know, why do you investigate all of these things? And at the moment, I just, into my head popped two reasons. One is I investigate the Bible because I want to know what God has provided for me. Mm-hmm. I want to understand who he is, what he's done for me, what the future holds, what blessings he's given me. I want to understand everything that he wants me to Paul's prayer that we can plumb the depths of his love and his grace. And then the other thing that I do it so I'll have answers when I talk to people like you.
Yeah, that's right. And I would even throw in a third, that digging and searching and reaching, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fulfillment in it. And there are times we come together and we say, look, Jesus made us right with God. How he did it? Exactly what particular theory? Well, should we think about it as a courtroom where Jesus is the judge and he says, I acquit you?
Right.
Or is it an adoption into the family of God? We would all agree that whatever Jesus did on the cross, it made us right with God. Mm-hmm. And there are differing ideas that are presented in different parts, a judicial view, a familial view, etc. There is the atonement, and then there are the theories of how the atonement is to operate.
Right. Yeah. Ken, what if somebody comes along, a skeptic, and says, I grant that we need logic. I'm persuaded by your portrayal of its usefulness. However, if your God exists, maybe what we have here in the Western world particularly is a subset of all the logic that's available in the universe. If there's a God or not a God, maybe there's logic to be found in other cultures. So similar to, I guess, the philosopher John Hick and his elephant.
Yeah.
We're touching on a part of that elephant. So we've got that truth, but there's other truth.
Yeah.
Could there be other logic is my question.
Yeah, that's exactly where we want to go. And that's a very powerful analogy. You know, it's an Eastern analogy that you got men who are blind. You got a half a dozen of them. And the king, in order to illustrate his experiment, brings the elephant in and they touch different parts. And, they say they touch a leg. Well, it seems like a pillar. They touch the trunk. It's like a snake that I saw, touched it out in the wilderness. They're all right, but they've never really understood the elephant. And so that does take us. And in fact, this is what my friend continued to say. He said, I took a course in college logic. However, it is derived from the Greeks and Western thinking, which is ingrained in our culture and society. However, in recent years, I've encountered Eastern views of reality and logic, as well as modern efforts toward integrating Eastern and Western schools of thought. And he cites an article and a particular book. Well, how do we think about that? Because it is true, the Western world and the Eastern world think about things very differently. I've talked about this consensus that views the laws of logic as kind of being the explanatory principles of the nature of reality. But, you can be a Zen Buddhist, and you can have these koans. One of them that most people have heard of is, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Well, as an Aristotelian, as a Westerner, clapping is by definition two hands. What do you mean, what's the sound of one hand clapping? But the idea is that in Eastern thought, you can have these absurdities, these contradictories, and yet they contain their own truths. You see it in Buddhism. You see the effort of Buddhists to convey that idea. You see it in Hinduism. Now, this is how I responded here. I said, I think it is fair to say that the consensus of historic Christianity, including philosophers and theologians, is that these three laws of thought, law of non-contradiction, law of excluded middle, law of identity, are not just one version of logic, but rather reflect the very nature of reality. While this is sometimes referred to as Aristotelian or Western logic, in actuality, Aristotle didn't invent these laws. Rather, he discovered and formulated them. Yes, there are other so-called forms of logic, especially Eastern, but these so-called logics of the East usually reject the law of non-contradiction, accepting an either-or differentiation, it affirms a both-and synthesis. The problem, however, is that the laws of logic are necessary for all rational people and must be universal to all cultures and worldview. A person cannot significantly think, speak, or act without relying on the laws of logic. Now, let me unpackage that a little bit. It's not like... What's an analogy that I can use? Here's an analogy. When I go to England, I've been there a couple times. They have different ways of doing things in England than they do in America. The old joke that it's two countries divided by a common language is true. The same word means different things. I was listening to a British author read this book written by Alistair McGrath about C.S. Lewis Alive. And when I drive to work, I thought I'm kind of tired of listening to music on my way to work. I want to spark some ideas in my mind. So I'm listening to this, and the British author, when he says schedule, he says schedule. And when he's supposed to say issues, he says issues. And I'm thinking, wait a second here.
He's got good control of his tongue.
Yeah. And but there are other times there are French words and he gets it right. And I'm like, wow, this is kind of an interesting idea. It's not like that with the laws of logic where, you know, if you're in the Western Hemisphere, you follow the Aristotelian format, but when you take a trip to China or England, all of a sudden there's a brand new different logic that appears. When people in India and China take their high blood pressure medication, they don't read the prescription in mystical terms. They read it in take one of these pills every day. I think what's interesting, when it comes to the STEM disciplines, when it comes to science and technology, when it comes to medicine, when it comes to engineering, there isn't a lot of postmodern relativism and mysticism.
In working at JPL, I became friends with a Hindu engineer. He was an engineer.
There are a lot of them.
Yeah, he's an engineer working at JPL, and he hadn't tossed aside his religion that
his
he was
Hinduism.
Raised in.
Mm-hmm.
He still believed, and we had conversations about it. And he had a different take. He could do engineering, and he had to obey or follow the laws of logic to be able to do his engineering. But somehow, when he clicked over to his religious beliefs, he was willing to accept contradictory concepts, things that didn't make sense. And in fact, he felt that that had merit.
More appeal.
Yeah, more.
Fulfillment.
Yeah, that was an element of mystery.
Yeah.
And that's what he wanted. And so it had to be mysterious in order to be satisfying. And that meant it had to be non-logical. And, of course, we have to be careful in our Christian thinking that the mysterious can't be logical.
That's right.
The mysteries about God somehow can't be logical because then they wouldn't be mysterious anymore.
No, that's a great example. In Western, so-called Western logic, now I'm going to argue there isn't Western logic,
right.
There's just logic.
Yeah.
But in the so-called Western logic, the Aristotelian logic, you have two ideas that clash. They negate or deny one another. They can't both be true. So you have this differentiation. In the Eastern logic, so-called logic, you have the both-and synthesis. So these two ideas that seemingly contradict, no, they're both true. even though they negate or deny one another, there's truth in both of them. So instead of a differentiation, there is a synthesis. Now, let's unpackage some of this, these ideas. I had a friend who was a missionary to India, and he talked with a lot of the citizens there, and he worked with many who were had backgrounds in science and engineering. And as you know, India has an amazing influx of people in the sciences and in the STEM areas. And so I asked them, well, how do they work during the day in the science technology world of rationality, but then on the weekend, maybe on Friday, they go to the temple where things are not a logical contradiction. There's a synthesis, you know, where all realities become one. The book is everything that's not a book in India, in the temples. And he said, well, they live a compartmentalized life. Or many of them have given up their Hinduism. But see, Christianity says there aren't many types of logic. God created the world. And so reason and logic are discovered by all people in all cultures. So Aristotle is called the father of logic, but not because he invented it, but because he began looking at the foundations and saying, well, here's a way we might be able to articulate it and summarize it. He put it together so that we could kind of appeal to it and rely upon it. But I mean imagine a world. It wouldn't be a magical world. It would be a nightmare world where, you know, something can be and not be at the same time and in the same respect. I mean, imagine a world where God and the devil, there's no difference.
You can't trust.
You can't make this differentiation and this distinction. Now, Dave, you alluded to it, and I think it's right. There have been times where maybe people in the West have overemphasize the logical categories and have not allowed enough for the mysterious, but that's still very different than saying that, you know, the experimental conditions of quantum mechanics mean that the laws of logic are thrown out. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that a mystical world is a very, very difficult world to navigate. I think the reality is that Buddhist logic and Hindu logic just simply contradict these laws that are so foundational. And the laws of logic don't remove mystery, but they guard us from the deep errors of contradiction. And so I said to my friend, you know, I think you want to be careful about adopting the idea that there are different kinds of logic or moving into, mysticism. I think what we need to realize is that the principles of logic are true of all worldviews, mm-hmm. and they're true of all people. So this was kind of an interesting dialogue and discussion of a philosopher on one hand, a scientist on the other. And I come back to something I said in the previous program. You know, having worked here at RTB for working on year number 22, I listen very carefully when Hugh Ross talks, when Dave Rogstad talks, when Fuzz Rana talks, Jeff Swearing, very carefully when AJ talks, and I have noticed that we approach things differently, mm-hmm. that we ask different kinds of questions, that a part of us moves in this direction, whereas I might move in a very different direction. And so, when I look at, on straight thinking, I like to have a good dose of science in our discussions or in reflections. I like to have a good number of articles that touch on the science faith side, because it's very easy for me to fall back and just do a general apologetics. I like philosophical apologetics. I like history. I like these other particular areas. So I like to say, hey, I'm chipping away at the RTB science faith issue. But what's interesting is notice how I looked at quantum mechanics philosophically. Mm-hmm. I want to know, how do they relate to the laws of logic? So I think that in apologetics, you have science apologists, you have philosophical apologists. A lot of times we have to listen to each other. And I've learned a lot, I think, about science. Of course, when I go home and try to explain it to my wife or my children, I'm like, I don't know, I have to go back and talk to Dave about physics again.
You know, it's interesting, this idea of alternate forms of logic. In mathematics, say in the field of geometry, there's Euclidean geometry, which is, you know, the work of Euclid and others, you know, and it has certain axioms, and a key axiom, sort of a fundamental belief, is that parallel lines don't cross one another. But then there have been more recently, in recent centuries, an investigation of what are called non-Euclidean geometries, where parallel lines can cross one another.
Oh, boy.
The geometry, well, it's not so strange. If you think of the geometry of the surface of a sphere, the lines that are the longitude and latitude lines, they cross at the poles. And so that geometry has to be treated differently.
Yeah.
Triangles have to be treated differently in that realm than they are in a flat realm, which is a Euclidean geometry. And of course, the question arose here 100 years ago, is the world in which we live Euclidean or is it non-Euclidean? And Einstein's theory of relativity made use of a non-Euclidean kind of geometry to explain some of the things that he saw or he theorized about. But there's still this fundamental question that hasn't been totally resolved, and that is the geometry of our, on the large scale in our universe, is it Euclidean or is it non-Euclidean? So there are these different geometries, and the question is, which one really applies to the real world? But that doesn't necessarily mean that logic fits in that same category.
And you could say that when it comes to forms of reasoning, there's deductive, inductive, abductive, where the laws of logic remain, but the level of proof or probability or plausibility, there is this range of issues. I want to cover one more thing, just a bit more. In a Western sense, and remember, I don't think there is Western logic and Eastern logic. There's just logic. But often in a Western sense, it's either or. It's the clash. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Eastern logic, it's both and, the synthesis. Now, it's not to say that two ideas couldn't come together, but if they're not contradictory, I might say, well, here's A and here's B. They conflict, but I might be able to create a synthesis from A and B and come to C. But if A and B really do contradict, if they negate or deny one another, I'm not going to be able to pull that synthesis. I'm going to have to change it. So you have the dialectic, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in communism, you have capitalism and socialism, and then there is the synthesis of world socialism or communism. But again, if there really is a negation and a denial, then you're talking about things that are illogical or absurd. Mm-hmm. And so I want to encourage philosophers and scientists to talk to each other. I want to also encourage our listeners to appreciate that God is the source for these conceptual truths, that God is the one who makes sense of all of this, and that appealing to the laws of logic or to the laws of physics or to mathematics or to morality, whatever they may be, I think Christianity or a biblical position, a Christian theistic position, makes the most sense of that. And I also want to give some tools that people can follow up on in this context. In my book, A World of Difference, I have a discussion of the laws of logic. And I talk about them in their application of worldview thinking. And there is also a discussion of an Eastern worldview and how it relates to a Christian theistic worldview. So in some respects, a very good book for these kinds of discussion would be my book, A World of Difference. Joe, is there an RTB book that delves into quantum mechanics? Can you think of one?
Not specifically.
I know we have some videos by Erica Carlson.
Yes.
Who's done some...
Jeff and Hugh have written blog posts on it through the years. So if you type in quantum mechanics, you'll find stuff.
Well, very good. There you have that question of a very interesting and unusual and counterintuitive experimental world of quantum mechanics in the backdrop of the laws of logic.
All right. Terrific. Good. Thank you so much. So we're going to have a philosopher and a scientist continue to talk over a sandwich.
Talk to each other. Yeah.
All right.
The really important stuff.
Right. We'll leave it at that. Thanks again for listening. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.